Hello and welcome to Tales from the Doghouse, Separation Anxiety Explained. I am Ness Jones from nessjones.com or Separation Anxiety in Dogs Decoded, and with me is...
I am Stacey Bell from Focus Fun in the US. You can find me at focusfun.net.
What are we talking about today, Stacey?
What we're talking about today is the Pareto Principle. So some people know it as the 80-20 rule. 20% of the effort gets 80% of the results kind of thing. And it was interesting when I was looking at this, the guy who discovered the Pareto Principle, actually he was studying, he didn't really name the Pareto Principle, but it was the guy's name, his last name was Pareto, but he was looking at it in how it related to 20% of the class had 80% of the wealth, and then others started seeing that this 80-20 rule applied to a lot of different things in business and in life and in time management and all different kinds of things. So then it became the Pareto Principle, named after the guy who first was looking at it, but he didn't name it the Pareto Principle. Anyways, my point is that I thought it would be interesting to look at how the Pareto Principle could be applied to the training that we do with dogs that are struggling with separation related behaviors.
Yeah. What do you think? And I think there's a, I don't want to say the opposite, but so you've got 20% of effort creates 80% result, but the flip side of that is it can be 80% of effort can achieve 20% of results.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not always, I mean, I think people call it the 80-20 rule, but it's not always 80% and 20%. The main thing is that there's some contributing factors that are the vital few, is the terminology that is sometimes used. And that's where you should focus your energy. That's what would have the biggest results, impact on your results if you work on that part of it versus the useful many, which it's a lot of little things that can even consolidated won't affect your results as much as that vital few. So it's easy to get distracted because there are so many little things, but we're gonna always focus on our vital few, those few things that make a big difference on your results.
Mm. So how do you think that applies to training a dog with separation anxiety?
Well, I was thinking about that. And I do think one of the things that, you know, will help you in determining what that vital few, those things that are going to make a big impact on results, is looking at, you know, what do we think are the main contributors to separation anxiety? And for me, I think, I mean, yes, we can go down the road of looking at genetics and early life experiences and all of that kind of stuff, but I'm really trying to break it down to the basics, saying like lack of exposure, lack of security and exposure to scary or over threshold experiences. Like I'm trying to break it down to like what we know instead of like what we can maybe guess about a particular dog and their background and that sort of thing. So that is kind of what I was thinking of as your a box. I do everything in flow charts, so it's hard to like do a visual through talking, but like say that's your main box is contributors to separation anxiety or separation related behaviors in general, the lack of feeling of security from the dog and exposure to over threshold experiences, which may just be contributing to that first one. Did you have others?
No.
Okay. So then I had branches off of that. Like,
is your flow chart you talking?
Is frustration a part of it?
Right.
Right. So like for some dogs, it's all anxiety based. And for other dogs, it might be all frustration based. But for a lot of dogs, there might be like some combination of both. So, you know, while I think enrichment is an important thing for all dogs, if we think frustration is playing a part of this separation related behaviors, then that would be something that we would also look at. Then my other little box is the hyper attachment piece. And if the dog is hyper attached to one or two people and have trouble settling with other people, then we have to, you know, then we're thinking about other ways to help them form relationships with other people, or, you know, so that they can be kept in that secure frame or under threshold. So I was, you know, kind of thinking at it from that level, and then trying to say, well, what are the things that we do as part of our training protocol that affect those things the most? And so what I came up with was that, you know, managing absences is a big one for minimizing the exposure to those over threshold experiences, or those scary absences, as we sometimes call them. And then building security, because it's hard for dogs to feel safe when they're experiencing those scary absences. So managing absences is a big one. And then gradual exposure. So we're keeping them in that safe place, and then increasing that time slowly at their pace would be the other one. So those would be like two things that I would say you should do: manage absences. And if I had to pick only two things for somebody to do for their dog who is struggling with separation anxiety, those would be the two.
And they're the 20%? Is that what you mean?
I think they are the 20% that gives us 80%.
Right. Okay. So managing absences and gradual exposure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you can argue, like I was arguing with myself, in fact, when I say you can argue, I was arguing with myself about things like, well, what about enrichment? And what about, you know, diet? And what about vet care? And what about, you know, like all of those other things that are important? And I guess, like, for me, I would say those aren't unique to separation anxiety training protocol. They're like kind of like what I would feel like every dog should have. Yeah. And so if I'm just looking at like a separation anxiety training protocol, then I would say those two things are
essential.
My go-to essential pieces of the puzzle to get your big results. So what are some things that you've heard clients kind of maybe on some of your onboarding calls or maybe in your group talking about things that they've tried that they didn't think worked that well, or maybe see people getting distracted by some training things that you don't think that maybe make a huge difference on their ability to stay home alone?
Well, using food would be one, letting the dog bark out, perhaps crates, things like that. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was thinking, especially crates, because you see a lot of people spending a ton of time, like, so if their dog is currently unhappy in a crate, you see a lot of people spending a lot of time trying to get their dog acclimated to a crate, and then trying to leave them in the crate, just because, you know, it is on the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
In the crate, right? So I do think that's one of those that's that's really common to get distracted by.
I think the crate thing is going to be an issue down the track. I mean, if some European countries have already banned it, unless it's for medical use, it's, you know, relying on a crate. And as you say, so I've had so many people say to me, oh, we tried the crate, but my dog hated it, didn't like it, didn't work, couldn't train it to be comfortable in there. So that's definitely one that doesn't yield results.
I would say that 90% of the people on my intake form, I say, you know, what have you already tried? And I would say 90% of the people have tried the crate as an option. And, you know, every once in a while there is that dog who does better in the crate. Right. But most of the time that's not your solution.
A discovery call this week, and you know, she was on board with leaving the dog out of the crate, but she was worried that things were going to get destroyed because it's a teenage dog as well, so and it's really rambunctious. He sounds gorgeous actually, but yeah, a little bit teenagey, and you know, worried about leaving the dog out of the crate because of what might happen, because it's a Labrador as well, and we know Labradors like to destroy things. But I mean, obviously, and she said, I think I managed to get her to you know, appreciate that there's going to be a camera on the dog, and you know, the dog's never going to get to the point where it's going to go over threshold. But then she said, well, I have to convince my husband of that because he wasn't on the call. And she said, I know exactly what he's going to say. No way.
Yeah. Well, and that one can be tricky, especially if the dog is also getting into stuff just as a source of entertainment. Like, because so you know, like, not even out of anxiety, if the dog is also getting into stuff just for the fun and joy of it.
We had a black Labrador. I grew up with a black Labrador, and he unfortunately, my dad wouldn't let him in the house. He was an outdoor dog, but which was disappointing. I think he dug holes in the lawn. But at night he was locked in the laundry, and he had these sheepskin rugs, like, it's not 1970s sheepskin rugs. One was bright purple and the other one was bright orange, and he was pooping purple and orange carpet. He used to take towels off the line and dresses off the line, all sorts of things. So yeah, teenage Labradors are a handful, that's for sure.
They are. I love them though.
Yeah,
I do love them. So other things that I was kind of thinking of that you see a lot in discussion groups or, you know, articles on the internet or whatever, blogs, I guess they call them, as opposed to articles on the internet, is the flitting game. So whereas you kind of go around your house, you're like flitting around, like moving around, and in hopes that you moving around so frequently and not really doing anything of interest, that your dog will start to kind of check out and become desensitized to your movement. So that is one that is probably in that effort category, the useful many, the category that it's easy to get distracted by but doesn't really have a big impact
on. So that would be the 80% effort equals 20% results.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
That would be in that
just
category.
For clarity. And I guess the other one would be the whole picking up your keys, putting them down, putting on your shoes, taking them off, putting on your jacket.
Yes. Yes. So starting out that way.
Yeah.
So starting out with the pre-departure cues instead of like waiting a bit. That can be a big one. The other one is the no follow routine, which I guess would be kind of similar to the flitting game, but can also be like include some mat training, all of that kind of stuff to me. Desensitizing to interior doors, unless you're using them as part of the exiting, but is another one. Or just having your dog be alone in a different part of the house from you when you're still home can be another one. A lot of people feel like that's like a stepping stone to leaving. And I haven't really found that a dog that can be in a different room from you for an hour does better with you leaving the house. No, for some dogs, it's even harder. Like if I went in, my dog doesn't have separation anxiety, but if I went into my bed, like I can go downstairs or upstairs and he's fine. But if I went into my bedroom and closed the door, he would be, I mean, he wouldn't panic, but he would be a little bit anxious, you know, because that's not
normal.
That's just not normal, you know? So that would be harder for him than me just leaving the house, you know? So some dogs are like that. My dog before him was like that too. If he was gated separate from me, that was harder for him than if I just left the house. Right.
That's a lot of effort, isn't it? It's a lot of effort.
It is a lot of effort.
Like, a lot of stress for the dog, a lot of stress for you, like, oh, I've got to do this. And the results are minimal. Well, can be, it depends, but yeah.
Yeah, it can depend. And it also, I mean, my other caveat for all of that is if it's a goal of yours and if it's important to you that your dog can, for example, be in another room from you for a length of time, then do that training. But as far as helping your dog be home alone, that's not necessarily going to tie together. So that's just, you know, if we're looking at helping your, like solely helping your dog be home alone, then that wouldn't be one of the top things I would pick at all. So just something to kind of consider there. But again, some people maybe work from home and need a little bit of space for that reason or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. So it could be anything. I had an interesting call yesterday, which I won't go into. It was a bit, yes, but needed a door shut to a room for a purpose.
Yeah, for a purpose. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that happens. And if that happens, then we work through it. But I'm just saying, if it's not necessary for your setup for, you know, whatever reason is the reason, then not something to work on. Mm. I mean, I think you can also apply, I was trying to think of other areas to apply this kind of Pareto principle to the training. And I was also thinking of it in respect to what we track, right? Like, so it can be, there are so many variables and so many things that may matter to your dog as far as is home alone time going to be easier or harder for them? And so you could really make a fantastic spreadsheet with all of the things, right? And you could get lost.
Why would you want to do that though?
No, and I'm not saying that you should do that.
But I hate spreadsheets. That's why I'm carrying on, because I hate spreadsheets. Oh my
god. Flowcharts. Spreadsheets and flowcharts are really good. Anyway, but that would be really time consuming, right?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, in a way, you know, if you're looking at all of those factors, we know the common factors that make a difference to whether it's easier or harder, like who does the leaving, how active the dog is at the moment, or sometimes that it can be how much exercise or activity they have had. But like one of those two, time of day can be a big one. Weather can be a big one for some dogs, especially if they're sensitive to thunder and lightning and stuff. So, you know, so I guess what I'm saying there is it can also be applied to how we track things. Instead of tracking everything under the sun, we can, if we're noticing a lot of variability, and we're trying to assess the information, we can say, okay, let's track these five things that we know for a lot of dogs are, a source of differentiation as opposed to like, is this easy or hard? We can track it with this dog to see if we can find any clear trends as opposed to tracking everything under the sun. And then you kind of get to the point where it's an obstacle to even doing the training, because you're like, this takes up so much time. I don't even want to address it. Right. So that's kind of another one that I was kind of thinking that you could apply that principle to.
Yeah. And I think it's really important with this training. I mean, having a dog with separation anxiety is pretty overwhelming as it is. So I think when we're looking at this training, it's really important to break it down into simple, easy steps and not, you know, like obviously having that data that you're talking about is important. But if you're just overwhelmed by the whole process, then take it one baby step at a time.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you know, when I'm working with new clients, I'm not even collecting that kind of data in the beginning. I'm just saying, let's just train, right? And then as we start to see some trends, okay, so when both of you leave, it's harder. Okay. You know, that's not always the case. So we're not going to go in with that assumption. But if I start noticing that, then okay, let's go ahead and separate that out, or, you know, not do that in the start of training, or, you know, whatever we decide is right for that family. But I'm not going to track a bunch of stuff if it doesn't matter to the dog. Cause some dogs are like very flexible, like, okay, train here or there, anywhere, that's fine. Mm. And other dogs are very particular, you know, like this one little thing is different. That's like a whole context change for that dog. Right. And so you kind of have to, you know, like you're saying, when you're first starting out training, you're learning the camera, you're uploading videos, you're learning the app we use. And so there's a lot of, there's a curve there. There's a learning curve there. So, you know, we want to make it as easy as possible by, you know, we're just low key looking for trends based on the information that we have. And then if we need to, we can separate stuff out or collect more data. But in the beginning, we're just like, we're just doing that in the background. So it's not overwhelming. So do you have any more thoughts?
Not really. I mean, I'm obviously trying to tie it all back into the Pareto principle. And I think, you know, taking those baby steps, especially at the beginning, you're going to, and when you think about it at the beginning, we're trying to build those solid foundations. So setting the bar for success, and that does include baby steps. So you are probably going to get better results than if you,
I think you hit the nail on the head though when you were saying that, you know, having a dog with separation anxiety or really any behavior issue is overwhelming. So if we can just focus on the stuff that really makes a difference instead of doing all of the things, then I think we're not only serving the client and the dog better, but we are getting better results for the amount of effort we're putting in.
It's like I'm just trying to think of a good analogy, like a recipe. If you've got but let's say you're making a spaghetti bolognese, you could just chuck everything into the pan and off it goes. That would just be like throwing everything at the wall, wouldn't it? You fry your onion, or no, maybe brown your meat, and then you fry your onion and your garlic and your red pepper, and then, you know, you add that to the meat, and then you might stick in some tomato paste, and you let it all sit there and smother away for a while, and then you might add in something else and something else and something else. So it's building it up gradually so it tastes better. And if you just lumped it all in at once, okay. So you get better results, right? 20%.
Yeah.
I don't know actually if that would be more effort though. When you think about it, it's more effort, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe.
Let me do another analogy.
Okay.
I love analogies. Dog training. So you want to teach your dog to pick up, if you want your dog to sit somewhere, and then you're going to throw a dumbbell. This is the end result, right? Throw a dumbbell. This isn't a very good analogy either, actually. Throw a dumbbell, the dog has to jump over, grab the dumbbell and come back to you. So you're not going to go, you're not going to expect the dog to do that straight away because you're not going to get the result. So to get the result, you have to start with a little bit piece of the puzzle, which might be just getting the, teaching the dog to hold the dumbbell. So that's the beginning piece. So we're chaining that behavior. But if you, this is a terrible analogy as well.
Okay. So try to think, I know you like analogies, try to think of an analogy where 2080 thing, like so that you're like maybe, can you think of a recall analogy?
Well,
I'm trying to think of a, we have no analogies. Okay, skip the analogy part then, I guess.
Most of the time when I've seen the Pareto principle, it's been about businesses, you know, like, you know, or who owns the top 20% of the world's population own 80% of the wealth. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I guess for like for recall, for example, like, so if we're trying to apply it to another dog training thing, we might say that the things that there's a lot of different things that you can do, right? But the things that, and I'm not a specialist in recall, so I don't know why I picked that example, but we already did the separation anxiety example. So now we're doing this example. So we might say that the three most important things are that your dog has a, you have a repertoire built up of reward strategy. Like, so if you use a clicker or if you use a word, but the dog knows where to go and how to get that reward. So that might be a really important thing. Another important thing might be handler focus. Even outside of your sessions with recall, you're working on your dog checking in with you and noticing and building your relationship, that kind of thing, handler focus. And then the last thing might be something about distractions. Okay. So you're going to focus on those three things. So you're going to focus on reward strategy, handler focus, and working around distractions as part of your recall strategy, right? And so there's other things that are tangential to that, but your main things are those three things in building a good recall.
So probably. Does that apply to the Pareto principle though?
Because you're not focusing on all of the things, you're focusing on your top three things. The three things,
right.
Or in this case, we're going to say it's 20%. Of the things that you think are going to make the biggest difference in your recall, right?
I really don't like maths.
Okay. We can take out all of the, examples that we just gave, and we'll just stick with the separation anxiety. We'll stick where we're solid.
It is an interesting principle, you know, like saying that if you've got a room full of people that it'll be 20% and they're having a discussion, it might be that 20% of the people in that room will be the 80% loudest voices.
I think that's true. And you notice in organizations that 20% of the people, like especially when there's like I do in our church, I do my thing is outreach. And so I do a lot with the refugees and some homelessness, families struggling with homelessness and stuff like that. And what I notice is when I'm looking for volunteers, it's like this 20% of the people are volunteering consistently. And like the other 80%. So it's like that 20% of the people are doing 80% of the work. Not that they're the only ones doing the work, but like they're doing a majority of the work. They're the ones that I can count on to step up and show up and do the things. So it's really interesting that way that you, I mean, you can also see it in organizations like that.
So you're saying that then if we apply that to separation anxiety and there's a household of maybe four people, there's probably going to be one person that does most of the training.
And that's totally what I see in families, is that there's usually one person who's the dedicated trainer. So yeah, that's another good way to apply it is in that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Fabulous.
All right.
So that was kind of a brain exercise.
Oh, God, it stretched my brain.
Who hates math?
I'm an English person of, you know, language person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hear you. I hear
the
you.
The word.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. All right. Well, hopefully people that are a little bit more mathematically minded than myself will get a lot out of this episode.
I think the biggest thing to remember is to focus on the things that are going to make a big impact to your training, especially if you're feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
All right.
Well, thank you guys for joining us today. Remember to do all of the things, subscribing, rating, reviewing, all of those things. We would really appreciate it, both in your podcast world and on YouTube if you watch there.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Cool. All right.
Signing off from Ness Jones. You can find me at nessjones.com.
And I'm Stacey Bell. You can find me at focusfund.net.
Yeah. Bye.
Hope you'll join us next time. Bye.